but I can at least learn something and try and have more empathy for them and make it a little bit less bad in that moment for them by being there for them. And yes, I might carry some of that pain, but I'm going to learn to find ways to let go of it for me and to still be healthy for my family and those that love me.
Welcome to the Off Duty Podcast, the podcast where we interview the men and women of law enforcement and help you to learn about the person behind the badge. If this is your first time tuning in, thank you. My name is Anthony McNeil, retired police officer and your host. Let's get started.
Welcome to another episode of the Off Duty Podcast, number 136. I am super excited for the gentleman I have joining me on this episode. I think he's the first Canadian I've had on the podcast. And the reason why I'm so excited is because I have a lot of supporters up in Canada, and you guys really represent when it comes to listening to the podcast, and I greatly appreciate it. Right behind the U.S., you guys are number two, and I really, really appreciate you. This gentleman joining me today is a husband. He's a father. He's an author, a blogger. He's been in law enforcement since 2006. I am happy to have joining me from British Columbia, Canada, Mr. Mark Bouchard. Mark, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much for having me on, Anthony. It's a real honor to be here.
If you're a regular listener, welcome back. If this is your first time tuning in, I hope you hear something that makes you want to continue to listen. I like to start each episode off with the same question, and that is simply, Mark, why law enforcement?
Yeah, that's a good question. Like a lot of people, I think I kind of found it by accident. I certainly watched crime happening. My parents have a small business, and I watched their business get broken into more times than I could count. And it would always escalate. Like, they break through the windows, so you put bars in the windows. And then they break in through the neighboring business. And then they break in through the roof. And eventually, they drove a truck through the front of the things. So you have to put little pillars up in front of the business. And there's always a new way of they'll find a way around. And like that time, they stole two monitors, two flat screen monitors, and they did tens of thousands of dollars of damage. And so you just see that, and you want to help, you want to make it better. And like most people, I've sat in on lots of recruiting interviews. And pretty much everybody says, oh, why do you want to be a cop? I want to help people. And we all joke about it once we're on the job and we start to get a little more, you know, jaded and whatnot. And sometimes we don't feel like we're helping people. But at the end of the day, I got on because I wanted to help people because I saw the impacts in my life and those around me and just wanted to try and find a way to make things better.
It's funny talking about the criminals and the break-ins. If they put half that energy into something positive, it'd be amazing what the world would be.
That's so true.
Once you got into the profession, was it what you thought it would be?
No, it wasn't. And I think, you know, we learn about policing from watching TV and from reading the news. And I think we more see like the critical incident side of the job, the danger and the shootings and car chases. And as you'd know, for every time you do a car chase or have these major incidents, you have just hours of paperwork and you're dealing with all kinds of other things. Like, I've obviously spent a lot of time on patrol or general duty, as we'd call it. And yeah, you deal with all kinds of variety of situations. And that's really important, is getting a chance to really interact with people and try and make a difference in those day-to-day things. And that's where I try and always find a way to make a difference. If it's a missing persons, right? And it's a kid who doesn't have a lot of support, you actually go follow up and go talk to them and really make a difference. Even times you're dealing with homeless people, you're dealing with people addicted to drugs. You're trying to help them to get some support. You're trying to support them in whatever way you can, just to try and make something better in their world, you know, and have a positive interaction. I even do that. I spent a year and a half on traffic. And my goal, even if I gave someone a ticket, was to have them thank you at the end of the interaction. And not to be like weird about it, but just like be nice to them. Treat them with the same respect that you'd want and treat them with fairness. And I'd often ask people for their input. Like, hey, you know, you need to get this windshield fixed or headlight fixed. How long do you need? And people just leave feeling like they've been treated fairly. And it's what we'd want. Because at the end of the day, I've been pulled over just like you probably have, just like every member of our family has. And we'd want them to be treated with the same respect. And it's those little interactions that help to build a positive feeling around the police, which is what we need. Because we're here to serve people and help people. And I think sometimes that gets lost in society. People lose sight of the fact that the police are here to help you. Yeah, you might hear about a police shooting or something that you think is a negative interaction, but it's because they don't understand police tactics, police psychology, and really the challenges that the cops are facing every day, which are just unimaginable to most people.
No doubt. Now, I've mentioned that you're from Canada. Is policing in Canada greatly different from policing here in America?
It's hard to say because I haven't policed in America. I think it's a bit different. Like we probably have a bit less guns, a bit less homicides, murders, some of that. Like it almost depends. Well, I'll even rewind. With policing, like I studied police culture when I was doing my master's degree. And what you actually find is there's a lot of subcultures. So like policing here, say my detachment, I've worked for two different organizations and there will be a different culture within my detachment now versus my old department, which was more, I'm kind of more rural, small town now. And before I was like suburban department of a big city. And I would say you see the same thing between Canada and America, right? If you just have a different culture that the police are within and the police, then these little departments or agencies or even subunits within a department form their own cultures. So I would say ultimately, yeah, I think policing in Canada would be a bit different just because we'd face slightly different challenges than the US. But at the end of the day, the basics of the job is the same. Like the whole point of the police is to serve and protect, to help people. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges the public doesn't understand is they don't understand the realities that we face in that job. And I think they get little news clippings and headlines of like, I'll give you an example, but up here in Canada, there's one every year that comes out and it's essentially like police still shoot too many, expert says, is the headline that comes out. And it's just not true. The reality of what most of police interactions are, we aren't using force in a typical interaction. And often even once someone reaches a point of grievous bodily harm and death, the police officer still doesn't shoot. They put themselves at great risk because we have such a powerful resistance to using lethal force.
When you look at the
psychology of it, like someone like Lieutenant Colonel Grossman and his books on killing and on combat. And I didn't know that, but I've spent about 10 years on our emergency response team, which is the SWAT team up here in Canada. And I've now been in several situations where I've been very close to shooting people. And I didn't understand that resistance until I've been in those moments where I've had people point a gun, you know, pull a gun, both those were imitation ones, a few other ones with real guns that have been very, very close. And also just from talking to other officers of when someone's coming at them with a knife and then they drop it at the last second and the officer had the finger on their trigger, they're half a trigger pull away. And because I've been through some parts of that, I'll pull them aside. I'm a peer-to-peer support member and I'll say, hey man, how you doing? And like you can see, they start tearing up. It really hits them. And sometimes it's parts of the job that we're not expecting that hit us. And I think we all kind of understand danger and death and shootings and kind of those side, but we often don't understand the emotional side. And me, when I started, I went to a fatal car crash, a very sad car crash as a new officer. And I had to go do the next of kin notification where you notify the family. And it deeply impacted me. And I had no expectation of that. I thought, you just leave work and what's wrong with me? You just hang your hat on the door and go home and everything's fine.
Right.
And for years, I couldn't even think about that call. Like I couldn't talk about it at all or I'd break down crying because I was carrying a level of vicarious trauma. And I've actually heard you, because I've listened to several of your episodes, and I heard you talking about one that impacted you where there was a very sad case where some children died. And that was the one that really hit you. And part of what I've started doing with my blog and even the book I've been writing is I want us to learn more about this stuff so we're ready for it, because I wasn't prepared for it. So I started writing a book to prepare like what I needed to know 15 years ago that no one taught us, because no one teaches us how to resolve that emotional pain. So, you know, essentially having heard you speak about it, I'd maybe like to ask you kind of, did you find anything that worked for you that maybe helped you to be able to let go of some of the emotional pain so we don't like essentially need to carry it forever, because there are healthy ways to let it go?
Yeah, I'm different in that other than that incident that you talked about or any incident that really involved children, nothing on the job really affected me. And why I think that is because I never allowed police work to become my identity. And therefore, when I was done, I was done. I left everything at work. To me, it was just a job. It was a fantastic job, one that I loved. But everything that came with that, I just took it as that. That's just part of the job. I didn't take it personal. I didn't allow it to consume me. I didn't allow it to come home with me. I didn't allow that to linger. And I think part of the reason why is because when I left the job, I had other activities to keep me focused. When I went back into the job, I was there 100% giving my all. When I left, I'm back 100% doing whatever it is that I need to do, whether it was my family, my business, anything like that. So I think for me, a large part of it, and I think maybe, I mean, I've been out of the game now for 10 years, but just from what I've seen and from talking to officers in this new generation, maybe this is changing a little bit, but I think a lot of cops only focus on being a cop. They think that's all they are capable of doing, and therefore it becomes their identity. And when it becomes your identity, all the things that it encompasses becomes a part of you, the good and the bad things. So you carry that weight of all these things that you see and deal with on a daily basis. And if you don't have any other outlets, yeah, you got, you know, guys go hunting and fishing and do things like that. But those are just things that are in small segments of your life, I guess you can say. And for me, my business consumed a lot of my time outside of the job. So when I left that job, I was done with it. I didn't think about what happened that day. I shouldn't say that. You know, things would cross your mind, but it was nothing that I would focus on. And I think I was able to really compartmentalize the job from the rest of my life. And I just considered it just that, a job, because I knew that whether it was me or somebody else, I could be replaced in a heartbeat. And because of that, I didn't want to feel like that was something that I had to have in my life, if that makes sense, because I could be replaced. I didn't put the importance on what it meant to be a cop, because one, I didn't really want to be a cop in the first place. I always wanted to go into business. The gist of what I'm trying to say is you got to have outside interests outside of the job. You got to have outside friends. And I think when you do that, it allows you to not focus so much on the things that you see and deal with every day on the job. And it does help to have people that can relate to what you've gone through, to bounce things off of when you need to. That's important. But at the same time, you also have to have a different perspective, because 9 times out of 10, those people that you're bouncing things off of in the profession are probably going to be skewed in a direction that, you know, that you are. So it always helped me to have friends outside of the job.
Yeah, I think being a healthy, well-rounded person helps you to be a good police officer as well. I know I've learned a ton from books, and Dr. Kevin Gilmartin writes a book, Emotional Survival for Law Enforcement, where he talks about how important it is to have those different senses of self when, like, your whole identity is I'm a cop, and he uses that term, I am a cop, instead of, you know, I'm Mark and I'm a hockey player and a father and a husband and all these other things. And then we have no control with our policing career, because, you know, so much is driven by management and what we're ordered to do, and we're being investigated and all these other things. And then it really impacts us in such a negative way. Whereas when
no doubt
you can go to work and love being a cop and enjoy it. I love being a cop. I love what I do. I also love my time off. I look forward to getting to play with my kids and getting to go do things. And I think it helps me to be a better police officer, that I can disengage from that side and just, I purposely remind myself when I'm off duty to be off duty, like park those in and put your hands in your pockets every now and then. I'm not saying be totally clueless, but I am saying you need to let yourself calm down. You can't live in the constant hypervigilance of, you know, thinking a ninja is about to jump out of a closet and attack you every second. And the reality is some of us do. And I think the job can change us in certain ways, but it's healthy to down-regulate and to just let go of a little bit and just relax and calm.
No doubt. And I'll add, in today's police world, given that so many bad things can happen, even when you're out there just trying to do good, that officers can find themselves not wanting to stay in the profession. And I think it's even more important for officers nowadays to have, or to realize that they can do other things. Because that day may come where you may say, to hell with this. And I've had numerous guests now that have been on the show that were in law enforcement that left before it was time to retire. And they're now doing other things. And I think that's vital, that you have something outside of law enforcement that you can go to if needed. You know, and I think that alleviates a lot of that pressure. And I shared the story about when I left back in 95 to start my business. The one guy that I used to work with that we call the department asshole, the guy was miserable. And the reason why he was miserable, because he wasn't doing what he loved. He had a dream of going off and starting a gun range, but he was afraid to give up the security of law enforcement and his pension and all of that stuff to step outside to make that dream come true. And therefore, because he wasn't doing the things that he really wanted to do, it manifested itself in him being unhappy and coming to work every day and being miserable. And that's hard on anybody. And that's not just law enforcement, that's any job.
Yeah. With what you just said about people leaving, what I would love to see is that it's people leave healthy and because they want to. And be, like you said, you're pursuing a business. You know, I have a friend who left policing for a while to start a restaurant, eventually chose to come back. But it's not you're leaving because this job has injured you and we haven't prepared you for those kind of challenges. And I think historically, we've asked people to do the unimaginable. And we didn't know a lot about trauma and emotional pain and mental health stigma and even officer suicides. Like, there's so many aspects to this. And I mean, one example would be sleep. Like, I had terrible nightmares about, you know, work-related traumas. Like, they always involved shooting people, needing to shoot people. And my sleep was severely disturbed for years. And eventually, I started learning about sleep science. And here we, as a profession, and it's not just policing, but we throw you into all these night shifts and we dysregulate your hormones and your biology and we don't teach you anything about it. And you'd be there having a coffee with people at 4 a.m. who are about to get off work at 6. Well, no one told them that half-life of coffee or of caffeine is like 6 hours.
And it's, right. And that's probably your 12th cup by that point.
And then they got kids. Like, so a lot of us are very, you know, have problems with sleep and then the sleep will impact our, you know, trauma and how we respond to those kind of things. So it's part of what I started learning for myself. And I actually had a moment when I was yelling in my kitchen to myself, no one else around. And I said, like, so angry. Why don't they teach us this? And then that I couldn't even get my own organizations to teach it. And that's why I started writing my book. Was like, I'm going to just write about my experiences. So each chapter starts with like a story about that topic. And then the science I learned that helped me. So for example, chapter 10 is all about sleep science, where I just take the best books I can find on sleep and the best experts. And I say, here's the things they say, like, you know, here's what I spent all these hours reading about and learning. And here's what we don't know and should know. And here's the kind of stuff that'll help you to get through your career, because sleep is the most restorative thing we have. Like, you don't get better from your workout. You get better from sleeping and recovering after your workout. It's same psychologically. It's when our brain heals itself and cleans itself. And that's the good information that has really helped me to transform my life in a positive way. And that's the kind of stuff I wanted to find a way to share with other people.
You mentioned the book. Is there a title for the book already?
Yeah, it's called Setting My Sights on Stigma.
Do you know when it'll be out?
Yeah, it's set to come out in May of this year. Okay. It's self-published. I'm doing it myself. I'm just about finished the second round of editing with an editor. So kind of putting the final touches on a conclusion right now. And it's challenging to make time because I still work full time. Yeah, just still plugging away at it and getting super close. And I'm really excited. I put the second chapter, which is all about stigma, on my website. So for anyone who's interested, you can go to just my name, Mark Bouchard, Mark with a K, MarkBouchard, and it's .ca because we're up here in Canada. And that chapter, every chapter starts with a story, and it starts with my diagnosis of PTSD. And it goes, I met with a psychologist, and when he said, you know, hey, you got PTSD, and I said, if you ever say that again, I'm leaving and I'm never coming back, because I wasn't prepared for any of this. And he was right. I was suffering from many psychological injuries for many years, but I wasn't ready to accept it. And I didn't know anything about it. Whereas then I went on this long journey of learning about this and really healing. Whereas I think many people have this mindset of like, you're broken. Like, once you get injured, you're just, you know, you have a disorder for the rest of your life. And I really think we can grow from this. There's terms like post-traumatic growth and post-traumatic wisdom. And the reason I wrote this book, I spoke at a police training event for cops about mental health as an example of post-traumatic growth and how you can experience some real traumas and be impacted by them, but that you can put in a lot of work to get better. And for me, part of why I asked you what you'd learned through your experience was because I feel like I've learned so much the hard way. And I suffered for many years unnecessarily. Like, I think I could have really shortened that by having healthier coping strategies earlier. Things like talking to a psychologist, or for me, journaling was really healthy, or yoga, or all kinds of things, even gardening. Things that you told me 10 years ago I'd learned to like, I would have been like, that's crazy. I'm not gardening. I'm not doing yoga. You can't make me meditate. I don't want any of this. I actually said to the psychologist, he tried to get me to try this one treatment method called EMDR, which is proven to be very successful treatment for people with our kind of trauma. And I said, you can't make me try your voodoo, because I was just so stuck in that stigma. And I've had friends since ask me, hey, should I try EMDR? My psychologist has recommended it. And I'm like, well, do you want to have a good chance of getting better? Like, I can't guarantee you it'll work, but I can guarantee you if you try a whole bunch of treatments and you're willing to try, you're willing to put in the effort and you're open to trying them, there's a decent probability you'll get better or you'll improve from where you are
today.
What
are some of the steps or what's the process for that in terms of how it works?
Like EMDR specifically, or just talking to a psychologist?
Yeah.
So EMDR, that's the thing. To me, it was all weird, right? That's why I used the term voodoo. It didn't sound believable. But really, the history of EMDR was, I believe she's a psychologist. I think her name's Francine Shapiro, where she's walking in the woods and she starts darting her eyes from side to side, like walking amongst the forest. And she was thinking about painful memories and she started to get relief from that emotional pain. And then they eventually developed this treatment where they have you don't have to talk about it, which also is really positive because it's hard to talk about these things. And they don't, like, no one explains that to you. But anyways, basically, you just think about this thing. And then they move their either pen or hand or finger kind of side to side. And that somehow hacks your brain to help release it. Basically, the best way I can describe it is it like strips that emotional load from that memory. So I still remember things that are deeply terrible memories, but I don't carry around this emotional pain in my backpack with that memory anymore. So like, as an example, it came up for me when I had the suicide of a loved one. And that was one of the things that really kind of pushed everything over for me before I went off on stress leave for a couple months. Like that car crash I mentioned, if I even thought about it, I'd break down crying. Well, the first time I journaled about it, I wrote for 4 hours and I literally was crying almost the whole time. But what I've learned since from reading from a bunch of psychologists is how healthy that is for us to actually, like, instead of keeping all this pain inside, I heard this one psychologist say, she's like, you can actually just bring it and put it down here in my office and it can just sit there. And she's like, I don't even have to pick it up. It just stays there. And there's so many different ways of doing that. And so like EMDR is one and journaling is another. There's a whole host of ways that are proven through science to work. And the thing is, we just need to destigmatize a bit of it so that instead of being like, oh, I'm injured and I'm affected by all this and no one can ever know. It's like me. I'm going to sit in my basement. I'm going to get super drunk every day and it's going to just keep getting worse and no one will ever know. That's why I talk about it. So now it's like I go to work and I talk about what the things that impacted me. And I don't share the details of the events because I don't want to re-traumatize people with my trauma. But I just try and normalize what we go through, the kind of things we deal with, how challenging they really are and how sometimes they impact us, how that's totally okay, but and that we can often heal. And the sooner the better. It's like a physical injury. If you wait till your leg's fully broken and you walk around on it for 5 years, it's probably never getting back to very good. But if you go physio early, it probably never even breaks. It just, it kind of hurt a bit and then it started to get better and I kept going with it. Whereas
absolutely
one of the books that inspired me was Romeo Dallaire, Waiting for First Light. And he was the Canadian general that ran the peacekeeping mission in Rwanda. And he didn't get help for a lot of years. He didn't really understand it, but he came back. And then when he finally tried to get help, he found it so hard. And obviously he experienced unimaginable amounts of trauma there. But in his book, he really advocates get help earlier. And he wrote it to try and destigmatize mental health. And I'm inspired by people like him. And that's part of why I share the hardship of my experience, and more importantly, the lessons I learned so that I can try and help others to, not suffer for so many years like I did and to grow from these things, to be ready for them and to be able to handle them better than I did.
Yeah. Given everything that you've gone through, could you see yourself going back and doing it again?
You mean like policing or?
Yeah, going back into the profession.
100%, man. I'm still in it. So much good has come from it. Actually, in writing the conclusion, I'm essentially trying to write a story about that. And I'll tell you a little version of that. But like, you take the bad and you find the good of it. And with things like the fatal crashes and the emotional pain, it's made me learn to appreciate every day. We are not guaranteed a tomorrow. I tell my family I love them every day because I am not guaranteed that I will get another day, nor that they'll get another day. And I don't say that to scare anyone, but you just see the sadness of when, you know, we lose people.
Yeah. And the day is coming for all of us where it's going to end.
Yeah.
Whether we want to or not.
Well, and so make the most of that time you have, you know, enjoy it. And I really, like, some good did come from it. I'll give you an example. But I grew up in a family that didn't talk about emotions and feelings. So it's weird for me now to be someone who writes about it and talks about it. But it was hard for me to even tell my parents I love them. Right. And eventually I got to the point I would say it to my dad. And I started doing some comedy. This was the first joke I ever started telling. What I'd say to my dad, like, "Dad, I love you." And he'd be like, "Okay." And then, "Dad, when someone says I love you, you're supposed to say I love you too." And he'd say, "I know." But it was hard for him because he grew up in a house like that. Yeah, and now, because I went through so much, eventually he called me one day to tell me he loved me, which was probably really hard for him. And now he regularly calls me and tells me that. He calls and FaceTimes my son and tells him that. And that means a lot to me. And that's the good that comes out of the bad. And I don't say it makes the bad easier. Like, if you're going to do frontline policing, you're going to see some hard things and you're going to have to find ways to process it. But part of what you can do is you make meaning out of it, right? It's, you find, hey, that was sad and that was hard, but you know what? That person lost their family, but I'm going to make sure to make the most of what I have and the time I have and the people I love so that, like, I can't change what's happened for them. I wish I could, but I can't, but I have to let go of that. But I can at least learn something and try and have more empathy for them and make it a little bit less bad in that moment for them by being there for them. And yes, I might carry some of that pain, but I'm going to learn to find ways to let go of it for me and to still be healthy for my family and those that love me.
When the book comes out, please let me know. I'll be happy to share it. I'm going to put a link to your website down in the show notes. So please go over and check out Mark's website. He has some great articles on there. I was reading a couple of them. I think you're going to find it very, very interesting on this topic that he talks about when it comes to stress and all of this stuff. I want to shift gears here for a second and jump into my first segment. This is what I call life. These are just several questions that all contain the word life in them. And the first question I want to ask you, actually, I'm going to start at the end because you kind of touched on this and I'm curious, but who's had the greatest impact in your life?
My dad. Yeah, my dad's a very, very good man. And I've learned so much from him. He's so kind. He's still working. He's 75 and he's an accountant. And he doesn't work because he has to. He works because he wants to. And that's what I remind myself, even with policing, when I go do hard things, I get to do this. I want to do this. And if the day comes when I don't, I'll leave. But it's a privilege to get to help people. And I've learned a lot from my dad, for sure.
I figured that would be your answer, but that's why I wanted to start with that. I could kind of tell from the way you were speaking about your dad, you know, and it's speaking of dad, you know, you talked about your dad when you used to tell him you love him, he would kind of hesitate to repeat it at all. But I've shared on the podcast, you know, my dad told me he loved me once in my entire life. And I never held that against him because I understood why. You know, my dad was the typical Southern black man where emotions weren't allowed to be shown. He grew up in that era where your way of showing love was to put food on the table, a roof over your head, and clothes on your back. And if you got those things, then that was love. That's how he was brought up. I believe that everything happens for a reason, good, bad, or otherwise. And even little things like my dad not telling me that he loved me, it made me a better person because there's not a day go by that I don't tell my kids that I love them. My dad was far from perfect. My dad was an alcoholic and he was a hellraiser and you name it. But even that, I learned something from him, what not to do. And I think because of the way he was, it made me a better father. There's been many people that have had an impact in my life, but when it comes to being a father, I learned a lot from him on what not to do in terms of being a father when it came to all that negative stuff.
And I want to touch on one thing you said and sort of cut you off, but the not expressing feelings, I think that was really common. I think that's what so many men have learned. Like, part of when I speak is to educate cops and first responders, but part of it's about men, because I had this like, cops don't cry, SWAT guys don't cry, men don't cry. I've heard it. I've heard the, one of my nephews getting yelled at, boys don't cry. What are you doing? And it's all bullshit. So instead we just keep this emotional pain. We just carry it around forever and suffer from it because, oh, I can't express and no one can ever know I'm weak. I actually say it's courage to address your feelings. It's courage to be vulnerable and express it. It's courage to find a healthy way and be able to move forward to be healthy instead of just being so worried that other people will judge you. I'll be honest with you. If someone doesn't like it, if someone thinks I'm an idiot or I'm weak, fuck them. I don't care. Yeah. And I think we need more of that. And when we hear it within our organizations or detachment of someone bad talking the person who's off, we need to have the courage to speak up and say, hey, man, not okay. Right. So I just think it's a culture shift. And I think we learn from those. Everyone does the best they can. Your dad did, my dad did, but we kind of learn from, we take what we can and we try and make it a little better for the next generation. And I hope my kids take it and make it better from where I give it to them.
Absolutely. What's been the most defining moment for you in life?
Being a dad, having kids, you know, getting married to my wife, been awesome. Being a dad is, I say to people, it's like the best thing ever and the hardest thing ever all wrapped into one. You know, being a parent, you're exhausted, right? And there's times when I take my phone out and I disengage and he'll say to me like, dad, put your phone away. But there's also the other moments, right? Where they're just awesome, where he'll come say to me like, dad, you're my buddy. Or I'll put him to bed and I lay down with him and he'll come give me a kiss or a hug. And it's all the little moments. I had no idea how much kids realize. Like, they're picking up on so much, and it doesn't matter what you say, it's what you do. They're going to see how you treat people, how you talk to people, what you do with them, and that's what they're learning every day. And I try and remind myself, it's like the difference of what's urgent and what's important. And there's always something urgent. There's a new emergency always, right? But what's important is things like being a good dad, and I try to... Okay. Actually, I was listening to it this morning. The last person on your podcast, I forget his name, was talking about put your phone on the other side. Mm-hmm. My phone's often, I'm on call a lot, so I kind of have to have it around. But you have to have those reminders of like, hey, disengage. And no, I'm not checking the work email. I'm going to just sit and parent right now because that's what's important right now.
Yeah, that was Eric Tong. He's out in the state of Washington. I think he was talking about parenting, and that was one of the things that he had mentioned, you know, just being present. Which is hard nowadays when there's so many distractions. But like you say, you have to make that effort. And I'm very guilty of that with all the shit that I have going on. And one of the things that my wife and I do, because it's just the two of us at home now, is every morning, and I can't remember where we got this from, but every morning we take just 10 minutes and we sit together, no phones, no TVs, no nothing. And we just talk. Just 10 minutes a day, because a lot of people don't even do that, you know, without distractions. And it's made us closer even after 30 years of marriage.
Good for you. That's important. That's connection. Like, you got to remember, you can't take that for granted. I like to remind myself, you never stop dating your wife. One of the books that inspired me for my book is a book written by Greg Amundsen, who was a former, I believe it was FBI HRT, but a former SWAT guy, left policing. And it's called Your Wife Is Not Your Sister. And he actually got divorced. And he went off and spent months writing the lessons he learned from the hardship and what he wished he'd known before. Yeah. And I thought that's so courageous of him to share the depth of the hardship so that I don't have to get divorced, so that I can do better as a husband and stay married.
I had this conversation a long time ago with a young guy that I work with. And I always try to tell people, you know, people always ask me, how you guys been married for so long? Believe me, we've had our ups and downs. We wanted to kill each other at some point. We thought about getting divorced. If you together for 30 years with somebody, you're going to go through all that. But at one point, there was a moment when you said, I want to spend the rest of my life with that person. And if you go back and you remember what that moment felt like, and you try to keep that moment alive, you can make it 30 years.
And the nice thing too, Anthony, is everyone's lives are better because of it. Like, that's the whole reason you get married, is you make it so it's hard to leave, because like your kids' lives are better, your lives are better, the companionship, like it's, you know, I married my best friend and I'm very lucky for that. And marriage is hard. Relationships are hard.
No doubt.
And I think sometimes we have this idea, like a false, it's like going to be like a Disney movie and we just have this like blissful never argue about anything, but that's just not, that's not real life. And
none,
I think,
at all.
By having the courage to share those kind of things, it's helpful for the next generation to hear, to just have different expectations so that they don't think there'll never be an argument in your marriage. Like, that's just not real. We're all people.
Yeah, that's total bullshit.
We have conflict, but it's like learning how to express it in a reasonable way and say what you need and still give love and support. And what you just said, like, create the healthy habits where you have 10 minutes to just connect. You put the phones away, because we live in this world where we'll all go to lunch and dinner and sit and play on our phone in front of each other. Like,
yeah,
it's not healthy. It's not good for us as people. And trying to create those healthy habits in our life and in our relationships, we'll build stronger relationships that are, they're better for all of us in the long run.
No doubt. What's been the greatest life lesson you've learned so far?
The greatest life lesson, treat people well. I think being a cop, a large part of your job is learning how to interact with people and how to deal with people. You know, my dad sent us all on like the Dale Carnegie course, and obviously I read Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. And it's just be nice to people. And really be a good listener. Like, and as cops, we often think we're great listeners and we're generally not. We're just in a hurry to get through this call and have this person stop complaining about this thing we don't think is important and we just want it to go away. And it's really hard to just shut up and listen and actually pay attention and give that person your attention and make this be important. But if you do that, they will leave thinking you had the best conversation ever. And I've done that where I talk with friends and family and whatnot, and I'll leave, and one of my buddies will say, like, man, my wife loved talking to you, she said you guys had the best conversation. And I'm like, all I did was like take an interest in what she was interested in and just listen. And just you can't fake it either. You have to actually care, because people can tell, like, our intuition can tell what's happening with other people. And actually, back to my book, chapter 8 is all about intuition, because it's so important for cops. Your intuition will warn you. I've had times when I say, that's a gun in that guy's waistband, and I was right, just from seeing a little bulge, because your intuition is so powerful. Yeah. But it does the same thing with people. Someone's playing with their keys. They're telling you they want to leave, and your intuition is picking up on that. And if you're in a conversation, but just looking the other way and kind of half paying, what? Maybe, yeah. Like, they know you don't care. So you actually choose to plug in, but that's tiring too. It takes a lot of time and effort.
It does. It really does. Good advice. One more question I want to ask you. And this is one of my favorite questions to ask the guests. If you had a person in your life that constantly spoke to you in the same manner that you sometimes speak to yourself, would that be a good thing or a bad thing? And how long would you allow that person to remain in your life?
It'd be a good thing. I've changed how I speak to myself, and that's having gone through the hardship of it. Like, there were times in my low time, you know, when I went off work on stress leave for about 2 months, when I was very critical of myself, and it came from like, what's wrong with you? How can you do this? You're weak. You're useless. Everyone, like, I was the meanest person to myself with all the things I said. And eventually I had to check those thoughts and just, you know, you still have moments when you criticize yourself, 'cause you're hard on yourself, but then you challenge it and you say, hey, no, I'm doing the best I can. I'm doing a good job. I should be proud of it. And so I now have a fairly positive self-talk, and I think I'm pretty nice to myself, and we should be. But I think our default is actually to be negative to ourselves, and we have to really choose to overcome that and learn how to reprocess those thoughts.
What did it take to make that shift and start having those positive conversations?
It wasn't working. I think too, I learned so much from people who've been through it before. Like, and for me, it was largely books, but you read these authors and a few of the ones I've mentioned who went through such hardship, and they were so hard on themselves. And it's easier for us to see it when it's not us, right? Like, we're so emotionally invested in our own life that when we can see it, and like, say we hear about someone else's relationship dynamic, and we can be like, our friend will talk to us and you're like, yeah, you're really making a big deal out of nothing on that one. You know what I mean? Like, we can see it because we're not in the moment. And it's the same thing watching someone else kind of go through some of the suffering. You can see it and you're like, what are you talking about? Why were you so hard on yourself? You didn't do anything wrong. And then by being able to see that for several of them, I was able to shift that to myself. And eventually I had to keep telling myself, I don't have anything to be ashamed of because I haven't done anything wrong. And I write about this in that chapter 2 on stigma. And that's so important, is we think, what's wrong with me? Why am I so weak? Why can't I handle it? And we're trying to live up to some false narrative expectation that we're RoboCop. you know, or that we're men who just don't have feelings. But if you turn off your feelings, the negative feelings, you turn off the positive ones. Mm-hmm. Then you're also the dad who doesn't tell your kid you love them, doesn't give them a hug. You're just this cold body that, you know, wanders through life. And that's not good either. So for me, it really was learning from people who'd written about this stuff before and learning from their experience helped me to be able to look at my own experience differently. And I think the turning point for me probably was that morning when I yelled in my kitchen, literally yelled, why the fuck don't they teach us this? Because I was so angry as I was just starting to learn it. And I remember it was when I stopped drinking. I'd been drinking heavily. That was how I managed my problems. And it wasn't working. And I went, I need to quit drinking. And I went, I can't. And it was 9 in the morning or something, like super early in the morning. And I went, okay, can I go an hour? Like I just changed my time frame and shrunk it down to like a micro goal. Well, yeah, I don't usually start drinking till nighttime because that's when the nightmares are going to come. I'm okay, then go an hour. And after an hour, set another hour. And eventually I did a day. And it was like a big deal to me that I didn't drink all day. And then I wrote on my little whiteboard on my fridge, I didn't drink today. I won't drink tomorrow. And I set a goal of making it 7 days. At the end of 7 days, I set a goal of a month. And you just kind of slowly start building on your success. Mm-hmm. And then I saw how much better my life got because of like things like not drinking. And now that I know a lot more of the science, I get it. It's super toxic for your brain. It interferes with your sleep. Right. It makes you feel a little bit better in that moment, but it makes it so much worse in the long run. And it's also how we get taught to cope, right? We got brought into like a policing culture where drinking is how you handle things. It's not a good plan, but it's been the way of the past. And part of what I would love to see change is to replace the things that didn't really work like that with things that actually are proven to work really well. And I think we'll be a lot better in the long run from it.
Oh, good shit, man. Good shit. I want to go ahead and jump into my last segment. This is my rapid fire round. And these are just two topics. Don't have to think about them. Just select one. Don't necessarily have to explain why. And the first one is night shift or day shift?
Day shift.
Ride single or have a partner?
Ride single.
Soak up the OT or not unless I'm forced?
Not unless I'm forced.
Starbucks or Dunkin' Donuts? But you're up there in Canada, so it's probably Tim Hortons.
Starbucks. Definitely Starbucks, even over Tim Hortons. Not even close for me.
Get involved off duty or make a good witness?
Get involved.
FNG as a partner or salt the old vet?
FNG.
Direct traffic in 20 degree or 90 degree weather?
Oh, those both suck. I'll go with 90 degree.
Cops or live PD?
Cops.
Donuts, filling or no filling?
Oh, man. No filling.
And the last one, honesty or loyalty?
Honesty.
Mark, I appreciate the conversation. This was fun. It was great learning more about you. Can you please share your social media so people can go over and follow you once again and all that stuff, the website and all that?
Yeah, sure. The best way to find me is on my website, markbouchard.ca, up here in Canada. It's Mark with a K. And you can find my LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, that kind of stuff on there. I'm not super active on a lot of the socials just because I'm pretty busy with work and whatnot. But yeah, just the website's generally the best way to find me.
And I'm sure there's probably something about the book. They'll be able to get the book through the website at some point.
Yeah. So you can actually sign up with your email address to be notified for when the book comes out. And like I say, as of right now, the plan is to release it in May. And I'm super excited. It'll be on Amazon. And yeah, I hope you guys like it. You can find actually chapter 2 on there right now. And I also, some of the books I talked about, I have a bunch of like book summaries and even organizational reports of the kind of stuff I'm talking about. If you want to learn more, I just write a little like 5-minute blurb. And it's the kind of books I feel they should teach us about, but we often don't get in training. So my answer was, well, I'm going to try and make it easy. And some of them is even, some of it's free, and some of them would be books you'd need to actually like click on a link and go buy it at Amazon.
And again, I'll put links to Mark's website down in the show notes. So please go over, sign up so you can get on the list to get his book when it comes out. And you can get our early jump on it and check out the first chapter or chapter 2. Any last words before we get out of here?
Well, thanks a lot for having me on, Anthony. I've really enjoyed listening to your podcast, and it's been a real pleasure to come and chat with you. So thank you very much.
Absolutely, man. Again, thank you for the support. And thank you again to everybody up there in Canada for the tremendous support that you guys provide to the podcast. If this is your first time listening, you know, go over to theoffdutypodcast.com and make sure you follow us on whatever platform that you choose to listen to your podcast on. You can link out from there, whether you're on Apple, Android, or any other device. You can do it all from the offdutypodcast.com. I had been teasing you guys a little bit on something that I was releasing, and it is finally here. And that is my coffee brand, Blue Java. If you go to bluejava.coffee, you can check it out. Not only do we offer some fantastic coffee, but more importantly, we've partnered up with Fund the First, which is a crowdsourcing platform, kind of like GoFundMe, for first responders. And each month, we're going to donate a portion of the proceeds to a different campaign on Fund the First to help out first responders and their families that are in need. So again, that's bluejava.coffee. Great tasting coffee. We're going to have some fun flavors coming out. We have four that we're starting out with, and I think you guys are really going to enjoy it. I appreciate you. Everybody out there, please stay safe. Mark, thank you again, sir. Stay safe up there in Canada, and I'll catch you on the next episode. I'm out of here. Bye-bye.